I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday. Before we get to our main thing today, we need to talk about the latest Disney news that has happened since our last recording, which is that Disneyland in Anaheim is about to be repurposed for a new purpose. Disneyland is being transformed into Orange County's vaccination super site.
Hmm.
Yeah, they are going to be distributing the COVID-19 vaccine. Disneyland was chosen because they have large parking, a large outdoor area to keep people distanced and safe, and also they are used to moving large volumes of people in and out logistically with very few problems. You know, they've got some people movers there and transportation to get people to and from sites. So, yeah, while Disneyland can't be opened as the actual park right now, some of the shops and things are open, but the park itself is still kind of closed as far as rides and restaurants and stuff. They will be turning it into a super site for distribution of vaccines, and the demand for vaccines are so high that they put up an app to get people appointments, and the app crashed.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Disneyland is going to be the first of 5 so-called super sites. Other sites will be announced later because contracts and stuff with the city are still being worked out. But Disneyland is the first thing. So I don't know. I don't know how I would feel about that. You know, we've talked before about how we're both looking forward to when we can get our vaccine, and please do get vaccinated, and vaccinate your children and vaccinate your grandma and vaccinate any stranger you can get your hands on. It seems so surreal to think that there are going to be people who are going to get life-saving vaccination in the happiest, most magical place on earth. You know? I don't know. It's such a weird bit of the times we live in.
Honestly, if I had to pick a place in Orange County, if it wasn't going to be like the convention center, it would have to be Disneyland, you know?
I'm pretty sure that the convention center will probably be purposed as well. Mm. But I think it's just Disney probably already has a lot of contracts, and they were just able to throw it together faster.
Yeah.
You know, a Disney legal team can throw together a contract in the time you can blink. So
I mean,
I'm pretty sure that probably sped it up.
Going into the park, there's the castle. Oh, here's your shot.
Yeah, I don't know where exactly in the park they're going to be setting up.
I've heard one of the parking structures, but that's one thing I've heard.
Yeah, I really don't know all the specifics. I just know that because of the way they're logistically set up to handle large crowds, and also that their area is able to distance people outside quite effectively while they're waiting, that's pretty much the big reasons that it was chosen. So also, I don't know if they're going to be repurposing any of the park staff for this, but you know, they've had to lay off or furlough or, you know, move a lot of people around because the park can't be open. So maybe some of the cast members on the ground that are used to working crowd control and other things might be able to get a job out of this. I really hope so. They're going to need a lot of staff to move people in and out and stuff, beyond just medical staff. They're going to need cleaning staff and all sorts of other things too. So hopefully some of the furloughed or laid off Disney staff can get in on that. So I don't know, but good use at the time for a place that is sadly having to sit unused in large part right now. So. And good for them.
The more people that get vaccinated, the sooner Disneyland can reopen.
And maybe some people will go get vaccinated just so they can say they got vaccinated in Disneyland.
Yeah.
You know, if that works, it works. I am for whatever gets people to get that shot. Like, whatever you have to do, you know, give them a lollipop or sing them a song or put them on TV. I don't
have
really
Mickey
care.
Have Mickey come out.
Yeah, have Mickey come out and do a dance for everybody that comes get vaccinated at the park. Whatever it takes, get those people their vaccines in as high a numbers as possible. So I'm all for it. Good job. And thank you. Thank you, Disney, for contributing to the cause. So, yeah.
Yep.
And now to our feature presentation.
And now, our feature presentation.
We are still continuing our look at the classic Walt era. We are skipping ahead in the timeline a bit all the way to 1950 with Cinderella. And to kind of bridge the gap between where we were at last week, where we were at last week with Pinocchio and where we are now. As we mentioned, Pinocchio came out right at the beginning of World War II. And that was a big hit for Disney because, as Kiki mentioned in that episode, a lot of people were not really interested in going to the theater because of the threat of the war. Would the war come to America? Would America have to get involved with the war? We found out the answer to that if you know your history. But World War II really suffered with Disney. Or Disney suffered as a result of World War II, especially once America got involved. They lost a lot of their animation staff because they all went to fight in the war. And Disney, since the theaters, you know, the theater business wasn't really working right, wasn't bringing the revenue, Disney had to take jobs from the U.S. government making propaganda films. Yeah.
You know, we have been talking about whether or not to discuss some of those propaganda films. We haven't come down firm on either side yet, I don't think. But they're fascinating. Maybe don't show them to your kids unless you can give them all of the context. Like, wait until they're teenagers and you can, like, really talk about it.
I would really love these on Disney Plus with the context, but...
Yeah, you can find a lot of them on YouTube. A lot of them have been preserved by fans, you know, with context. Some of them even. They are... bizarre, but important thing to know both about the history of America and the Allies during the war and also the Disney Company. So I do recommend you watch them if you're, you know, if you know the context and you're prepared for that, because some of them are a bit harrowing to modern audiences.
And the few movies that were released by the Disney Company, you can't really call them movies. They're just a collection of shorts presented as a movie. They're just, you know, the packaged film era, as they called it. Sometimes those shorts would have a theme. Sometimes it would just be random shorts. Here, this is a movie now. And that really wasn't what Disney was about, and that really wasn't making the money. But that's what they had due to the reduced manpower of the staff at the time. So we've reached the end of the war. Disney needs a hit, and they need a hit badly, because they were so much in debt, even with the, you know, making cheaper films as the package shorts, even taking the money from the U.S. government. It wasn't enough to keep the studio afloat. They needed a hit. They needed, you know, they haven't had a hit at this point since Snow White. Dumbo made its movie money back because it was cheap to make. The package films were cheap to make, and they made their budget back, but it wasn't a hit. They needed the next Snow White. That's what I'm trying to get to. They needed the next Snow White, and they came up with Cinderella. And that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, this was kind of a coup for Disney. Mm-hmm. Pretty big success. Lots of classic songs in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And Cinderella remains one of the major icons of Disney.
Yeah, I mean, Cinderella's castle is the icon in Walt Disney World in Florida.
Yeah. When we were talking about what four films we wanted to do for this look back month, we could have just done the first four films that Disney made, but we decided on doing the four films that really, at least the ones we hadn't talked about yet, that really form the early core of what you think Disney is.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Snow White, because that started it all, and it's still one of their major princess lines.
Mm-hmm.
Then Pinocchio, we get When You Wish Upon a Star, which is the Disney theme song.
Mm-hmm.
Cinderella is also, you know, we get Cinderella's castle in Florida. something angered my dog about that. and we get, you know, we still get all of the, you know, carriage rides in the park parades and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And then next week's film, we picked for a very similar reason. It's one of the iconic pillars of what you think of as Disney.
And as you mentioned last week with Pinocchio, When You Wish Upon a Star, it is Cinderella's castle that you see at the beginning of every Disney movie.
Yeah. So we couldn't talk about the kind of roots of Disney film animation without going through this one.
Mm-hmm. There is a uniqueness about this movie in that they wanted to make the hit, but they also wanted to keep it under budget. Their solution to keep this under budget was to completely film this movie in live action and animate over it, much to the chagrin of their own animators. We talked about this with Snow White, that was one of their ideas for Snow White, was to just film actors acting it out and draw over them. But the animators hated that. You know, they wanted that freedom.
Yeah. The interesting thing, though, is they had live action references for all the human characters, really.
Yeah.
And if you look at the references, they really do look like the characters.
Yeah.
They might have different hair, different styling, or, you know, whatever, but you can tell that the basic facial structure and body shape and stuff was mostly retained, especially with Cinderella herself. Both the live action reference and the voice actor, if you look up pictures of them at the time, they both look like her face is kind of a meld of those two.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rather interesting that you can pick out various features of both of them.
Is there anything else we need to talk about before we get into the caster?
I did want to make kind of one little interesting note on the music.
Mm-hmm.
There is a story that when they were doing Song of the South,
mm-hmm.
the writing team was having a lot of trouble getting together, and they kept fighting about that one. So screenwriter Maurice Rapp was reassigned to work on Cinderella. And all I can think of was, boy, did he get the good end of that stick.
Wow. Yeah.
The other guy got stuck with Song of the South, the film Disney has kind of almost completely erased from its vault. Maurice Rapp gets to write Cinderella, one of the enduring pillars of the company. So
the last remnants of Song of the South is about to be replaced with Princess and the Frog.
Yeah. So, yeah, that I find that interesting that one guy he couldn't get along with his co-writer and got an upgrade instead. I always kind of wonder which of the writers they thought they were doing the favor to. You know, it's like, we like this guy more, so we'll keep him on Song of the South, because that'll be a huge hit. You go work on the stupid princess thing. You know, I just wonder if it was like that or the other way around. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you want to get into the cast of this?
Yeah, let's talk about Cinderella herself, Eileen Woods.
Eileen Woods.
Once again, a Disney legend.
Yeah.
I love the story of how she got the job. So over 300 women auditioned, supposedly 300 women auditioned for the role of Cinderella. And apparently Disney hated all of them. Walt did not like any how they all sounded. But it wasn't until he heard the demo of the songs. So Eileen Woods was a friend of the two songwriters that were assigned to this movie. And as a favor to them, she recorded the demos for Bippity Boppity Boo, A Dream Is a Wish Your Heart Makes, and So This Is Love. And when Walt heard the demo, he just said, "That's my Cinderella." And that's how she got the job. She did not even audition for the role, and she got it.
Yeah, and she's brilliant at it. We talked before about my kind of dislike of the way Snow White is voiced. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love Cinderella. I love her. I love everything about the way she speaks. I love her singing voice. She's still a soprano, but she's not that like really high operatic kind of thing. So it makes it easier to understand her words, which sometimes the diction suffers a little bit in high lyric sopranos in the opera, I feel. But I just absolutely love everything about her performance. This was really her biggest role. She also did she also voiced Snow White in an audiobook release. But that was more to promote her upcoming role as Cinderella. So she also got to sing for Franklin D. Roosevelt at his home, and then got to go to the White House to sing for President Truman after she did a tour for people coming back from the war, men coming back from the war. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of her big thing. She had her own radio show for a while, but it was like a very short kind of interstitial little show. But this was the thing that really did push her through. She unfortunately had to sue the Disney company.
Oh yeah, yeah. This I know the story.
Yeah.
Her Peggy Lee and Mary Costa.
Yeah.
They all sued Disney for unpaid royalties.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that with Snow White, that Disney wasn't really good about paying royalties.
This had a lot to do with the VHS releases of those, of certain movies.
Yeah, which, to be fair, was not a thing anyone could have predicted when they signed their original contracts.
No, true, true. No one could, but still.
That doesn't get the Disney company off the hook, in my opinion, but it is understandable why that was not a, you know, a thing that had to be taken to court. We're doing it again now with online streaming platforms, digital releases, and every time there is an upgrade in technology or a new technology comes out, all these contracts kind of have to be reworked and redone with unions and such.
Yeah.
The thing that I did want to mention is that in her later years, she ended up getting Alzheimer's and eventually did not remember that she was the voice of Cinderella. But the nurses in the care home that she was in realized that any time A Dream Is a Wish Your Heart Makes was played on the record player, she brightened up, she was happier, she was calmer. It just improved her quality of life. So they began to play it around her, like, all the time, to keep her happy and calm and in a pleasant state of mind.
So it was still there somewhere. She just didn't know where it was.
Yeah, and we've talked about that before, about how a lot of people with those, you know, neurological conditions and stuff, that the music will be the thing. So, yeah.
Right. Let's move on to the evil stepmother, Lady Tremaine.
Yeah. She was another one that was kind of typecast, really. She was
Eleanor Audley, yes.
Yeah, Eleanor Audley, forgive me. She was given to roles that were not motherly in a warm sense, but, you know, the mother figure or the stepmother or the mother-in-law. She played a lot of those. And they were always kind of the standoffish, cold kind of mother. If you watched a lot of 60s TV or a lot of Nick at Night growing up, as we did, you may remember her face and all as the mother on Green Acres. She was Oliver's mother, Eddie Albert's mother.
She looks like Lady Tremaine.
Yeah, and she really did. She was the voice actor and the physical reference for Lady Tremaine. So they really did pull her facial. Just go look up a picture of her and you'll be like, oh wow, she looks exactly like Lady Tremaine.
Eleanor Audley also has the rare honor of playing two Disney villains.
We may get to the other one soon.
So yeah.
Maybe let's save that as a surprise for people who don't know. She is also the voice of Madame Leota in Haunted Mansion.
Mm.
She's the psychic medium character. Let's move on to our fairy godmother.
Verna Felton, another Disney legend.
Verna Felton. Yeah, I think everyone we've talked about so far has been named a Disney legend.
She's like, if you want to talk about a legend of the Walt era, she's pretty much been in almost every single one of these movies.
Yeah, she was in Dumbo prior to this as
Mrs. Dumbo. She was
Mrs. Jumbo. Yeah, she's Dumbo's the mother. Did she sing the song in there, Baby Mine?
I don't know.
That is possibly one of my favorite Disney songs in the history of ever. And definitely my favorite song from Dumbo.
the Queen of Hearts.
Yeah, she's the Queen of Hearts.
A certain other fairy in another movie we might talk about later.
Yeah, and she, we've already talked about Lady and the Tramp. She was Aunt Sarah in that, you know. Mm. But, yeah, just really, really cool woman, and also had a bit of a film career in person. But was mostly with Disney of a voice actor. Ended up in Jungle Book as well. I don't think we mentioned Jungle Book. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, Verna Fulton.
She played a lot of elephants in Disney.
Hey, you know what? If it gets you the money.
Yeah.
All right. So moving on, we have our Prince Charming.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess that's just his name.
Yeah.
They just named him Charming.
So we have William Phelps to do the speaking voice and Mike Douglas to do the singing voice. Here is a nice little story here. Mike Douglas was actually supposed to do the voice as well as the singing, but Walt didn't like his heavy Midwestern accent. Because he was from Chicago, Walt looked at him saying, yeah, that voice is not going to work for the prince. The singing voice was great, but the speaking voice wasn't going to work. So they got William Phelps to do the very few speaking lines that the prince has.
William Phelps, an actor from Indiana, who is mostly known for doing westerns. So... I don't know.
Maybe throw my hands Walt up. I don't know.
A bit full of it on that one. I don't know. Yeah, he really was. Let's talk about William Phipps first. He really was just kind of that guy. He did a lot of uncredited roles. He was a pretty solid working actor, you know. But mostly in the background. Interestingly, his final film role was in the year 2000 in a movie I absolutely love called Sordid Lives. It's a little indie, film that is, amazing. It's, a bit more adult, so don't take the kids to see that one, but, absolutely, amazing. He played a preacher character in that one. So, yeah, that's kind of fascinating that he was in a movie that I love a lot and have seen quite a few times. And also the stage play. My community theater did stage play of that a few years back. But let's talk about the singing voice, because honestly, that is the more well-known of the two. If you are of a certain age... you have already recognized the name Mike Douglas. He was the host of the Mike Douglas Show. He was a absolutely inescapable daytime talk show host for quite some time. And was before that a singer. He worked a lot in the big band era kind of thing, which is why... the Prince kind of has that sort of sound. It would have been a very popular sound post-war. That would have been what you would have been used to listening to at the time. Audiences of the time would have been very familiar with his voice because he would have put out quite a few hits. By the time Cinderella came.
Let's move on to our ugly stepsisters, Anastasia and Drizella. And so before Disney bought Fox, I would always make the joke, and a lot of people would, about when people say that their favorite Disney princess was Anastasia. Oh, you must really like Cinderella's stepsister. Can't make that joke anymore.
Yeah. We may get to that. But
this Anastasia.
Let's talk about this Anastasia. You better know her voice in another role.
Lucille Bliss.
She was Smurfette. She was Smurfette. If you're approximately the same age we are, this was your childhood. Yeah. You remember this voice. She was also Ms. Bitters in Invader Zim, if you like that. She was in every cartoon from right about this time, 1950, up until 2012, which is when she died. She was working right up to the end. Mm. So, yeah, you would recognize her voice from here and there and everywhere else, but mostly as Anastasia, the Wicked Stepsister, and Smurfette. She was also a mermaid in Peter Pan, mm. which we've talked about before, but I don't think we talked about her there. Mm. And as Drizella, the other stepsister, we have Rhoda Williams. Not really a lot in her career, although if you are a fan of old radio shows, she was in the radio version of Father Knows Best, I believe. I don't know if she was in the film, the TV version, that is, but she was the daughter on Father Knows Best for a bit. If you're a sci-fi fan, you also have heard her voice in passing because she did various alien voices in Star Trek IV and Star Trek V. But Cinderella is really kind of her biggest role that most people would know. We got our little miceys.
Jock and Gus Gus.
Jock and Gus Gus.
Jimmy McDonald, a.k.a. the second voice of Mickey Mouse after Walt got too busy to do the role, or his smoking habit caught up with him, depending on which one you believe.
Those two are probably his biggest, but he had a lot in the Disney universe. He worked a lot with Disney, pretty much almost exclusively, I think.
It was a sound guy.
He was a sound effects guy, and he began to invent things to make new sound effects, and started to add his own kind of vocal performances in there. He started with Disney in 1934 and eventually got a permanent contract as the head of the sound department for Disney. He worked for Disney all the way up until his death, and he was working on sounds for some of the Disney parks at the time of his passing. He shows up in weird places, but he's sort of best known for Jock and Gus Gus. Of course, we've already mentioned the Mickey Mouse. He's also the original voice actor for Chip in Chip and Dale.
Oh.
In the earlier shorts and stuff. He also does a lot of animal noises in various things. He's howling dogs in Lady and the Tramp. He's a wolf in Sword and Stone, hyena in Bedknobs and Broomsticks, that sort of thing.
Jimmy McDonald also does the voice of Bruno the dog.
Yeah, he's also Bruno the dog in this. I forgot to mention that. Thank you. And kind of the last one we're going to do a dive into is Louis Van Ruten, who is our king and also the Grand Duke. He voiced both of them. Once again, a lot of radio work. A lot of guest starring in television at the time. I do believe probably Cinderella is the thing that most of our audience would be familiar with. Most of his other stuff was in the 40s and early 50s in some lesser known films and such. We've also got June Foray as Lucifer. We've talked about her before. And as the narrator, we've got Betty Lou Gerson, who we last talked about as the voice of Cruella de Vil. So she returns as the narrator at the beginning of Cinderella. Or not returns, this was an earlier role, but returns to our podcast.
Yeah. You talked about Jimmy McDonald being a sound guy. It reminded me of another story featuring Eileen Woods. So hearing the demos for the songs, they were doing the recording of the song Sing Sweet Nightingale. And Disney had this idea of, I have this idea of soap bubbles, each one having a little Cinderella in it. And he had this idea of each one singing a separate vocal track. And could that be done? And there was this brand new technique called overdubbing. And this was one of the first major motion pictures to use it. Overdubbing now is pretty much standard in music.
Yeah. And honestly, Disney loves this trick. I mean, they sort of used it a bit in not overdubbing necessarily, but the idea of a character singing and harmonizing with themselves.
The biggest one, I hate saying it, would be the Siamese Cats in Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, we talked about it over Christmas in Babes in Toyland.
Yeah.
And even in Snow White, she's got that bit where she sings with herself in the wishing well. It was produced in a different way, but it's a trope that Disney kind of started right from the beginning.
Eileen Woods harmonizing with herself was, you know, kind of Walt's idea, and that was brand new technology at the time. And we have talked about in the past of Walt really liking new technology.
Oh, yeah. And it's, it proved to be very, interesting because we're still using it today. So,
yeah. Like I said, it's standard in music right now.
Yeah.
So let's kind of get into the story. I mean, yes, it's Cinderella. We don't mean to handhold it, but there's never a good reason why Lady Tremaine and the stepsisters hate Cinderella. Like, there's never been a reason. They just do not like her at all. Like, there's no reason for them to hate her.
Yeah, I think in the in a lot of the kind of original-ish versions, the idea was very tied up in her coming of age and inheriting her father's wealth and title and stuff like that. You know, it's a lot of upper class nonsense.
And as we see in the opening of the movie, they completely spend the entire family fortune on their own selfish desires and vanities and whatnot. To the point where the house is in complete disrepair and the only servant is Cinderella, which, that has to hurt. You're a servant in your own house.
Like, yeah.
You start out life being essentially rich. And your stepmom just spent all of your inheritance, and now you have nothing. You still have the house, but now it's completely disrepaired.
Yeah, this is one of the most enduring fairy tales. And not only in, you know, we think of this in the kind of, French medieval style, because that's what the Disney version is. Mm-hmm. But we have this going back to, like, you know, BC. In Greek, this was like an old Greek tale. We've got Chinese versions of this and Arabic versions of this. we've got the French version, which this is based off of. And then about 200 years after that, the Brothers Grimm puts out their, you know, kind of more Germanic version of it. So this is a worldwide story, which is fascinating that it's one of the more repeated tropes, I guess.
I mean, the term Cinderella story has been used so many times. It's a trope at this point.
Yeah.
The rags to riches, the underdog working to get to, you know, get success.
Well, it's not even that she works to get success. It's that, kind of in medieval fashion, you can't keep the aristocracy down.
Mm.
It's more of a divine right sort of thing, at least in the Western European medieval versions of the story. Okay.
Well, she would have a title. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, Lady Tremaine, by definition, that would make Cinderella's biological father a lord, wouldn't it?
Possibly. There were some times where women had titles in their own right. And the narration at the beginning does state that she was from a good family, which means she was of high aristocratic birth. So whether or not her title came from her husband or her father or maybe even a previous husband, because she does have the two daughters.
Yeah.
And those two daughters have the same name she has. They're referred to as Tremaines.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually don't think we know anything about the title of Cinderella's father, but it is absolutely probable that he would have been titled, because, you know, how are you going to get a lady of good birth without something of your own, you know?
Yeah.
But I question whether or not Lady Tremaine's title comes from Cinderella's father. So I really don't think we can say for sure, especially in the Disney version.
Though I must credit this movie for actually animating how an actual person would get up in the morning. Like, just completely, no, I don't want to get up. Mm-mm. Putting the pillow on their head, rolling over.
Well, I know when the birds and mice come into my window every morning and try to wake me up that I am very reluctant to get out of bed.
See, that's the thing about, you know, that's the thing about the biggest lie about the Disney princesses. It's not that the prince will come, that your prince will come. It's because when you sing, that animals will not clean your house.
Yeah, I could really use that. I don't really need the prince so much, but I could really use an army of, you know, hardworking animals to come help me with my household chores.
Birds and mice that'll make you dresses.
Yeah, and sewing. I mean, I wouldn't have so many half-finished sewing projects around my house if I had happy little critters to take care of the rest of it for me.
Let's talk a little bit of how all of these birds have clothes that Cinderella makes for them.
Yeah, all the little critters, the birds and the mice, all have little clothes that she makes.
That she has a whole drawer of these little clothes that she makes for the mice.
Yeah, and she seems to have, like, several outfits ready just in case a new mouse shows up.
Yeah, and she, when she finds out, oh, there's a new mouse in the house, oh, we have to go see our new friend. And, you know, opens the mouse trap, and there's, you know, a little chubby Gus Gus.
Who is very scared, as you would be if you'd just been caught in a trap, I think. And then a giant shows up and tries to stick her hand in there to get you out.
Yeah, but, you know, she puts a little shirt on him that's too small because he's a little chubby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cinderella needs a plus-size mouse collection.
Which says a lot, because there is at least another plus-sized girl mouse among these mice.
Yeah. I like to think that she was just, you know, this whole film takes place in like 2 days. Yeah. So I have a feeling that she, you know, she retailored. Of course, we see them at the end, the mice in the castle, and they've all got little uniforms and stuff. So I'm pretty sure that Gus Gus got better tailored clothes by the end of the thing.
I've seen the sequels.
You are ahead of me on that. I don't think I ever bothered. I will say something about the plot of this movie in general. We have talked for the last 2 weeks that Snow White was 5 minutes of plot in an hour and a half film. Pinocchio was more plot, but it was very chopped up and serialized feeling, which that's the book. We did mention that. Mm. But Cinderella feels like a coherent film that was written to be a feature film.
And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that they filmed it as a film before they even animated it.
Yeah, but you could tell that the screenwriters sat down and went, yes, it's going to be animated, but I am going to treat it like I would treat a live-action film in the writing of it.
Mm.
You know, yeah, it's a bit goofy because you've got the talking animals and everything, but it's treated as a theatrical narrative, which is, you know, new in this playthrough. It's not the first time they did it, of course, but by this point they were treating them as their own form of media, which I like.
Kind of bothered me on this rewatch. I never noticed before of the speech patterns of the mice.
Yeah.
It's something's off with that. Like the zoot zoots, the Lucify, Gus, Cinderella. It feels like there's something there that I'm not putting my finger on. Like it feels like there's something not quite kosher about it.
I get you, but I do also wonder, again, I can't put my my finger on anything specific, and out there listening, if you can, please let us know, because we will correct. But I do kind of wonder, though, if this isn't more, they're mice. Mice are high-pitched, and they have cutesy speech patterns because they're talking animals in a movie. I'm not entirely sure this was, like, targeted at any group or stereotype particularly, other than animals have cutesy speaking styles and high-pitched voices.
Even to the point where I had to turn the subtitles on just to make sure, and the subtitles completely get rid of the general accents that the mice would have and kind of just put their lines in there. So it makes me wonder what the point of it all is.
Well, it is harder to get accent across to, you know, in caption form.
I guess.
But, it is kind of difficult to understand them sometimes. But I really like the beginning with the birds because the birds don't really have speech. It's kind of interesting which animals have speech and which don't, because it's basically the mice.
Yeah, the mice can talk. Lucifer the cat doesn't. Bruno the dog doesn't. The birds don't. The horse doesn't talk.
The birds sort of talk, though, because they do have that kind of speech cadence to their tweeting.
Mm.
Because when they come in at the beginning of the movie, you know, there's this little bit where they kind of do this little sing-songy thing. But you can really feel the cadence of, like, wake up, Cinderella, you know? But it's like, do-do-do-do-do-do, you know? It's like, it's not words, but it's got the rhythm of speech.
Mm.
And given the context, you can kind of figure out what the birds are saying, which I always find fascinating on a linguistic level, like how our brain, there's not words, it's not language, but we understand it, you know, at least an English speaking audience will.
Mm.
But yeah, I find it interesting that this is the first of these princess movies we watched where she will talk to the animals and the animals will talk back to her and she understands them. But you also wonder if it's just her, because at the end of the movie, when Lady Tremaine is coming to lock her in and everything, and the mice are trying to warn Cinderella, we sort of hear it not from Cinderella's perspective. And it's a lot of like kind of squeaking noises. They go from talking rather clearly. And when Lady Tremaine shows up, it sounds more squeaky.
Well, Cinderella doesn't really have any friends, so she kind of had to make her own. So I guess that's her mind.
I just wonder, like, why the mice and not also the birds and the dog and the horse and the cat.
Disney has favoritism towards mice, don't you know that?
Yeah, I guess. Mice are the smartest creatures in the Disney universe. And the second smartest creature, according to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I believe. But, you know, it is kind of, if you live with an animal long enough, I can sort of decipher the general meaning of the sounds my dog makes. You know, I know when he's upset. I know when he's scared or angry or hurt or hungry, you know, because he's got different noises he makes for all of those. So maybe that's kind of their version of, you know, Cinderella has pet mice and she's learned their squeaks enough to figure out their general mood. I don't know. I want to talk about the opening song, not the opening song of the film, because that's just a forgettable, you know, it's like, hello, you're watching a movie about Cinderella.
A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes.
Yeah, Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes, the first, like, really proper song. I love this song. Two of my favorite Disney songs of all time are in this film. Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes and So This Is Love. Mm-hmm. I sing both of these in my house constantly. You know, this is, I sing this stuff washing the dishes and taking a shower and stuff. It's just constantly in my head. Oh, interestingly, about the main title that I didn't notice until just now, that main title that plays over the book opening and the credits and stuff, the female voice in that is Marnie Nixon, the wonderfully great Marnie Nixon, who's we've talked about her before. But she's the kind of voice over artist that did all the singing for, you know, The King and I, West Side Story, My Fair Lady. You know, it's her voice, with the act over the actress's, body movements. So yeah, that's her singing the beginning of Cinderella. How nice. But yeah, this, almost every song from this that is sung by a character is a classic now.
Yeah. And they actually sold the sheet music for every single song in this movie, and they sold like wildfire. That's how popular this movie was.
And all of the albums that they released of it.
Yeah.
And they still use these songs in Disney marketing today.
Yeah.
Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes was the basis of a massive Disney Parks campaign, what, 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. And I think they used Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo for like two campaigns before that.
Mm-hmm.
You hear So This Is Love quite a lot in Disney sing-alongs and stuff, because it's a very simple melody and very simple lyrics for kids to do. So that one gets a lot of play in sing-along media.
I forgot this one, but this is one I do want to mention. This, so we're talking about the songs. This is the first time that Disney released the music under their own record label.
Oh, yeah, it is.
We think of Walt Disney Music as, again, Disney, this big thing. They have their own, everything. But not always. Before, they would always release their soundtracks through other record companies. This was the first time they released it under their own label.
Yeah. And they still distributing through RKO by this point, though.
Yes, yes. They would
As far as the film.
They would still distribute RKO through RKO until Peter Pan.
Yeah. But I want to talk about how well this story flows, because after coming off the last two, there really isn't a point in this movie where you get bored or think, ooh, they just added that to pad time.
Disney finally found that flow with this movie.
Yeah, nothing feels wasted in this film, which I cannot say about the two we've talked about previously.
Mm-hmm.
There are still a lot of, like, sight gags and cute bits with the animals. You've got a bit of a Tom and Jerry-style chase scene with Lucifer and Gus Gus.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of... things breaking and things falling and tripping and stuff. So there's a lot of still the physical comedy and the humor that was developed through the shorts. But this is a far more serious film overall.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of characters that are there for comic relief. The King and the Duke are definitely comic relief characters. The mice are comic relief characters, as are all the animals, really. Yeah. The fairy godmother, to an extent, also a comic relief character. But it knows... Like, none of that ever feels cheesy. Even as an adult, it's enjoyable humor. It doesn't feel like it's aimed at a four-year-old. Which a lot of the stuff in Snow White and Pinocchio feels aimed for a very young audience, but this feels more like some of that classic slapstick that kind of appeals to all ages.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fairy godmother's lines, her humor bits, which are mostly vocal humor, it's jokes in the way she delivers her lines and her forgetfulness and stuff like that. They also don't feel like they're playing down to your intelligence or trying to be too goofy for a young audience, which is not something you can always say about Disney even today.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's very hard to hit that line where, there are no children in my house and we still enjoyed it. It's funny. It makes you laugh when it needs to. But, it's just generally engaging all through. I don't know how you found it, but I found myself really tuned into this one.
This movie still works. This movie, it's still engaging. That's what I'm looking for. It's still engaging. Let's talk a little bit about the King's own little side plot here. The entire reason for the ball. As he wants some grandbabies.
You can almost forgive the king because, one of the major points of being a king is you have to have a lineage, know? You have to have somebody there to take over. There has to be, the heir and the spare kind of idea.
Yeah.
And so far he's got his son, but his son seems to like to go off on adventures, and sometimes that was dangerous, and it'd be nice to have a backup, but the way they play it is more just, I super love little kids and I really want to be a grandfather so I can dote on children.
I mean, even later in the movie, he had this little dream of being grandpa and playing around with some little kids. And
giving horsey back rides to kids. Yeah.
And I love his little explanation. Like my son's grown up and he's so distant from me now.
Yeah, that progression with the pictures of, the small pictures of the kid, the prince is a baby and a little kid. And as he grows older, the paintings get progressively larger. And by the end, it's like current prince wall size, you know, floor to ceiling in a palace on a horse in a military uniform.
Yeah.
I love that. It's such a good kind of subtle joke, and you can tell that that one was for the parents rather than the children.
Yeah. I want to say this little thing is that when we see Baby Prince, he has blonde hair, and then he suddenly had black hair.
That happens a lot, though. Mm. With you know, actual humans, there is quite a lot of babies that are born with really light hair, and as they start to age, their hair darkens. I don't exactly know why that happens, but it is a known thing. And in fact, one of my favorite books growing up as a child, a major plot point revolves around the fact that the main character's sister had blonde hair as a little baby, and then darkened as it got older. I think there's just something that some productions like showing like blonde headed babies. I don't really get the
even in the King's Fantasy, the babies have blonde hair.
Yeah, they look much more like Cinderella than his own son, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So
let's kind of fast forward a bit to the proclamation of the ball, and every eligible maiden must attend. And they're just piling on the chores for Cinderella. Like, you are not coming no matter what. We are not going to give you any time to prepare for this.
If you didn't hate Lady Tremaine by this point in the movie, the point where she goes, I said, if. You know, that's the point where you're like, I hate her and would like to see her fall out a window.
Yeah, I mean, it's female dog-ish is definitely the term I guess you can use.
But she definitely is one of the more realistic villains in Disney history. We talked about that as well with Mother Gothel in Rapunzel, Tangled. But this idea of the vengeful parental figure that kind of makes life horrible for a child.
Again, we're never given any reason why they hate Cinderella. They just do.
Yeah. Also, remember in the 50s, there was still a lot of animosity toward blended families. I think we've gotten away, not entirely, but step parents aren't always portrayed as evil anymore, you know?
Yeah.
However, you know, this is 1950. We haven't really, you know, we haven't gotten to like the Brady Bunch yet, you know?
Yeah.
So the step parent who resents the other child or children in the relationship, definitely a thing. But I am going to say that I had forgotten about something, because they have the joke, of course, with Disney films that this very particular lime green color shows up around the evil thing in the film.
Yeah.
To the point where there's the acronym Every Villain is Lime for evil, you know? And I was sitting there thinking, and I'm like, you know, she's dressed in bright red for most, or the kind of blood red, you know, burgundy red for most of the movie and stuff like that. And then I noticed her eyes are that lime green color. They're not like a traditional green you would give an animated character. They are that specific, like, evil witch potion green color.
Yeah, when they do that big zoom on her face.
Yeah.
If she just sneers her eyes.
Yeah, you will notice in that scene especially, but it's all throughout the movie that they have colored her eyes that particular shade of green, which I find fascinating.
And, you know, Drizella's dress.
Yeah, Giselle's dress a little bit, but that's a little more tenuous for me. But that is like the exact shade when they show the eyes of Lady Tremaine. So I love it, and I love how subtle it is, but how keeping in the Disney theming, which is great.
It's almost like this movie has two, I mean, it's almost like there's two separate movies in here. You have Cinderella's story, and you have the Mice's story.
They are kind of an A plot and a B plot. I'm not sure I would call them two separate movies, because they are too intertwined.
Mm.
You can't really separate them out from each other.
Yeah, yeah, A plot, B plot makes more sense. It's just, you know, because we get so, you know, cutting back and forth between Cinderella and the Mice, especially when the Mice are getting the pieces to fix Cinderella's dress.
Yeah, the dress. I gotta say, that's some good dressmaking work from those Mice. I'm very impressed. It's an ugly dress. It's a hideous.
They're following
dress.
The book. I mean, but, like, Cinderella left them the book to go by.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I've sewn from patterns before, and my stitching isn't that good. Come on, that's some skill.
So clearly we need to get you some mice to make you some clothes.
Yeah. Yeah, the two stories are too intertwined for me to really separate them, but I love the way it works, because it does keep the movie from being too boring or depressing for the young kids, and also gives the audience a little bit of emotional relief, because honestly, some of the stuff between Cinderella and her family is just horrible.
A little comic relief, you know?
Yeah, so sometimes you need a little comic relief from the, you know, horrific trauma that is her everyday life. I just wanted to say, at the beginning of the movie, they talk about this was a kingdom of romance, and I'm like, what does that even mean? Like, was the whole kingdom under a love spell or something? I don't know. It's such a nebulous kind of word to me.
You also say it's full of tradition.
Yeah, so traditional romance, I don't know. Yeah. It's full of tradition, but the prince can decide to marry any woman in the kingdom whose foot fits a shoe.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that in pretty much all of the Cinderella stories, the stepmother and stepsisters pass her off as the scullery maid, and they do in this one. And in this one, the Duke says, I was told to try every maiden. So that means he's been spending all night going from house to house in the kingdom, from, like, you know, farmhouse to shack to, because that literally means any unmarried woman, and he's willing to try the scullery maid. He doesn't recognize her as the daughter of Lady Tremaine or anything. He is just, she's a girl that lives in this house, which means that he's probably breaking several royal laws about who can marry the prince, because royal marriages were always, you know, you didn't just marry the farm girl, you know? So it's lucky for him that the girl that somehow made it to the ball, which also you're only going to invite the cream of the cream when you're throwing a ball to find your prince a wife, you know?
Well, I think if from the king's perspective, it's just that doesn't have time to actually get any princesses from other lands. We need to get my son married soon. He was expecting his son to propose by the end of the night. We'll just have every single woman, they're there, and we'll figure it out later.
The interesting thing, though, is that the main conceit of this story doesn't really make sense to a modern audience. I think the reason why it does, why we're like, oh, this shoe only fits Cinderella because it was magically created. However, in the time period that all this was done, shoes would have been special made for each individual, and they would have fit your foot. It wasn't like a one size fits all, you know, go down to the store and be like, you know, I wear a size 8 shoe or whatever. It wasn't that. And if you wear medieval footwear, you realize that it very quickly conforms to your foot. You know how, like, when you wear a pair of sneakers for long enough and they start to, like, the soles start to kind of bend into the shape of your foot and whatever?
Yes.
The whole shoe would just kind of do that. It just kind of, at least the well-made ones, they kind of wrap themselves around and it begins to take the shape of your toes and your ankle and your, you know, whatever. I mean, it's really kind of fascinating how that works. So eventually you wear a pair of shoes for long enough and they really are your pair of shoes that don't quite fit anybody else in the same way.
Even
I don't
if it's
really
glass.
Know how that works with the glass slipper.
Yeah, that's the thing.
But they would have been familiar with the idea of these are my shoes and they don't quite fit anybody else the same way, which is not quite as common now, you know, in mass market shoes. But I do like it's one of those things that doesn't quite make as much sense. And Disney kind of does name check that a little bit. When the Duke is like, but more than one girl could be able to fit this shoe, you know. So then you're just falling back on magic at that point. But yeah. They do kind of check it for a modern audience. And the king's basically like, well, then find all the women that the shoe fits and my son will just choose one. You know, it's more like, well, at that point, one of those women is going to be the girl he danced with. So he can figure it out at that point.
Yeah. And I love the fact that Cinderella has no idea she was dancing with the prince.
Yeah, I really do like that. That it was, he didn't know her background. She didn't know his background. They just met and they just fell in love. It wasn't about position or title or any of that other stuff.
Over one dance.
You know, 10 minutes ago he met her. And they murmured their how do you do's.
And they sing a song together.
you didn't get that joke, but somebody out there will. So I don't know. I kind of like that. It's kind of sweet. Cinderella isn't out necessarily to marry a prince. She just wants to not scrub floors for one night.
Yeah, she just wants to have a good time.
Yeah, she just wants to go out one night and wear a pretty dress and dance. And honestly, who hasn't felt like that?
Yeah.
And who isn't feeling like that right now? I think everybody in the world wants to put on their best outfit and, you know, do their hair up and go out and just party.
Yeah.
I
Please
think
don't do that right now.
Well, not right now, no. But I think the second it's safe, we're going to see a massive uptick in people doing things. You know,
I mean,
think
that's people, what
people are
going to
bring back
that
dinner parties. I think people are going to start throwing lavish birthdays. I think, you know,
keggers.
Yeah, I think you're going to just be like, you know, hey, it's Thursday night, and there's a TV show I like on. Party in my place! You know, I've already seen friends posting on Facebook, like, the second it is safe, I am having a party at my house every single night. Anybody who wants to show up is invited. I'm just throwing open the door and putting a sign out that's like, anybody who wants to come in my house, come in my house, I will serve you tea.
And yeah, for Cinderella, the bonus was just meeting this guy that is completely into her.
Honestly, she doesn't realize it was the prince until the letter until the Duke starts coming around.
Yeah.
And she overhears Lady Tremaine telling her daughters that this could be the prince. And then she gets that dreamy eyes, starstruck, like, oh my goodness, the prince and Mary.
She completely gives herself away.
Yeah, maybe keep it inside. Conceal, don't feel. but it is really adorable that that's the first time she even realizes that was on the table. She was already just super happy having been at the party, having spent a nice evening with a nice guy.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes Cinderella one of the best Disney princesses, honestly, is because she's got such a good heart. She doesn't really expect anything from the world. She's in a horrible situation, yeah, but she still kind of keeps dreaming, and she's so kind to animals, you know. I love everything about her. She's such a great character. Also, Lucifer is probably my favorite cat in a Disney movie.
Because he acts more like an actual cat, or just...
Yeah, they really nail cat. You can tell that it's got the kind of, like, aloof, but still wants to be petted, but also kind of evil, but sort of sweet, but kind of, you know.
So, and, is Lucifer dead?
Well, I was going to say, it may be the only thing in this film to get a villain death. Because Lady Tremaine survives, the Wicked Stepsisters survive, they never get any comeuppance that we see on film. In this one. Mm-hmm. But Lucifer gets the classic villain death. However, as he's falling out of the tower, he starts on his back, and then he does that kind of cat flip.
Mm-hmm.
So I think their idea was like, don't worry about the cat. The cat's going to be fine. Cats land on all fours, you know?
From that height, though.
Yeah, I mean, it was like a five-story fall, so... Maybe he landed in a hay pile we didn't see or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I gotta love Gus guarding the key with his life.
Oh yeah, so adorable. Under the teacup, he's like, "This mouse is gonna eat me, but I swear I'm gonna guard this key with my life." I mean, this cat is gonna eat me, but one of the little bits that I love in this film that I had forgotten was in there is when the mice are doing the sewing.
Mm-hmm.
The girl mouse that's doing the sewing, she takes the needle, she takes the thread, and then she licks the thread and shoves her entire arm through the eye of the needle to thread the needle.
Yeah.
Which is like, if you can shove your entire arm through the needle, you don't actually need to lick the thread, but it's such a... It's what she would have watched Cinderella do, so I'm not even sure that it's a thing of, like, you know how sometimes you see other people do things and you're just like, well, that's just the way it's done.
Yeah.
And then later you'll find out that that was their own peculiarity, or it was done for a specific way and you don't have to do it anymore or whatever. But I just love the fact that she licks the thread before put it, because it's what you can't, like, not do that. If you've ever received a hand-sewn item from anybody... Their spit is all over that.
So I gotta say, one of the most horrifying moments in this movie is when the sisters are just tearing that dress apart.
Oh, that is... I had nightmares of that as a kid.
They rip off the beads, the sash. They just tear that dress to shreds.
Yeah. And I grew up pretty poor, and I had a lot of... When my mother was still alive, she made most of my clothing.
Mm-hmm.
She was an incredible seamstress, and she made quite a lot of my clothing. And so it was well-made clothing, but you could tell it was handmade. You could tell it wasn't like designer, you know, label clothing. But also, I had a lot of, like, hand-me-downs and Goodwill and stuff like that as a kid as well. And watching that as a kid and seeing the two girls go at it and just rip it apart, literally, yes, but also metaphorically, of, like, that's ugly and you don't deserve that, and what do you think you're doing wearing that kind of thing, was definitely something I experienced as a kid around other children. You know, you'd go to school and they'd be like, oh, I think I threw out an outfit that looked like that. Or, you know, maybe you're wearing my old clothes because my mom gave it to the Goodwill or something, you know. So, yeah, I had, like, every time I watched that scene as a kid, it was like, and watching it again as an adult, I was still like, oh, that's still somehow bringing up past trauma, yeah.
But I do like the following scene after that, where it's almost like the film is making fun of Cinderella by playing A Dream is Mr. Heartbreak one more time. And she's just hearing it, no, that's not true. You know, like her own song is coming back to her. It's like, no, it's not true. There's nothing to believe in anymore.
And then the fairy godmother shows up.
Yeah.
And makes it all better. And I just love the fairy godmother. We really haven't talked about her a lot, but she's such a good
character. She's like your favorite grandmother.
Yeah. Or like the really nice neighbor lady, maybe. Like, you don't see her often, but occasionally she'll show up with cookies and you're like, oh, yay! You know? Mrs. Johnson brought over cookies!
Fairy godmother, implying that she was at some sort of christening with Cinderella over here.
Yeah, I mean, maybe her mother invoked the fae spirits at Cinderella's christening. I don't know. I'm not sure how that works in Catholic tradition. I'm not sure if fairies are allowed to stand in as a godmother at a christening.
If she's the godmother, where has she been all this time?
Yeah, why now? You know, you couldn't have shown up and, like, given Cinderella a magical broom or something.
Yeah.
This will help you get all your chores done so that you can sit down for once.
But as we see, they get to give her more chores.
Well, yeah, but as any employee knows, your job takes, like, what, a tenth of the time for a lot of people?
Yeah.
So you just pretend to, you know, you learn to look busy. I kind of wonder if Cinderella's like, but I just did the drapes, was kind of like a, you know. I mean, I stood near them and pretended to, but they're drapes, so how are you going to tell?
Yeah. And that cadence from Lady Trim, do it again.
Yeah, such a good vocal performance in this from Lady Tremaine. So excellent in that it's not over the top. It's not like, hi, I'm doing a villain voice. You know,
it's just enough for you to hate her.
It's so realistic in the way, like, we've all talked to a person like that. Mm-hmm. The person who's like, they don't say anything specific to insult you, but, you know. So, I like that. And I love the, you know, the construction of, the design of everything. Let's talk about that real quick. The design of everything in this movie is beautiful. The outfits are wonderful. Yeah. The animal creatures are beautifully designed. The castle, of course, you know, looks wonderful. All the backgrounds, and especially Cinderella's carriage.
The pumpkin carriage.
Yeah, which may be one of the most iconic visuals from this. Because it looks like, it really does look like a fancy coach. But there are things in there that you realize are magical. Like the wheels, you could never make a carriage wheel like that. At least not at the time. Maybe now with like some kind of special alloy or something. But
they've tried it with the Disney parks, but it's more of a, they make it look like that, but there's, you know, actual wheels underneath it.
Yeah, you kind of have to hide it and make like an overlay that makes it look like that. But you couldn't actually, if you saw that in real life, it wouldn't actually work, you know. So there are touches that make you think magical instead of functional carriage, but it's close enough to a real world carriage that, you know, they can actually build replicas of it and use it in the parks. So I love that. And I love when the magic is breaking, you start seeing like the wheels revert back to vines and stuff, you know, it's just so cool how everything in this film, and once again, the the version that's up on Disney Plus looks incredible on a 4K television.
Yeah, this, again, this is from like a Blu-ray version a few years back. The restoration looks amazing, beautiful.
Yeah, that's probably the version that they've got up on Disney Plus, and it just, oh, once again, stop it on any frame and you could just put that on your wall. It's just so lovely.
And, you know, just the visual of the clock chiming 12 as Cinderella's running away, getting into the carriage, barely getting out before the gates close, and the guards going right after her. Like she's a criminal, but it's just that the prince really wants to know this girl's name, you know? And she doesn't know that, you know? She thinks that they're after her for other reasons.
Yeah, they know that the jig is up, you know?
Yeah. And everything's turning back to, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of joked about it before, like, oh, his name is Charming. But early Disney princes, as we have mentioned several times on the show, have zero personality.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, much like in Snow White, the prince is completely non-essential to any part of this story except for that's how Cinderella gets a castle.
Again, that's something that they fix in the sequels.
Yeah, but just going by this film, he doesn't really have a name. Mm-hmm. You know, I think later they retconned it and like, no, his parents actually named him Charming. But he doesn't have a name. He has almost no dialogue. He sings one song.
Mm-hmm.
and that's kind of, he's in like two scenes. You know, he's in the ballroom scene and he's in the end at the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I was so big on Prince Eric.
Because
it was one of the first Disney princes I remembered that I'm like, that guy has a personality. I know who that guy is. I could sit down and talk to that guy. He has an interest in music. He's a little bit snarky. He's, you know, fun-loving and adventurous. I get who that guy is. Charming is a cardboard cutout.
Yeah.
He's the male version of a sexy lamp. Do you know that trope?
Yeah.
That, like, women in movies are just a sexy lamp. You could replace them with a sexy lamp. It wouldn't change the plot. Mm-hmm. Disney princes, early on, are like that. They're a lamp with a title.
I guess one last turn of a knife from Lady Tremaine of tripping the footman to drop and completely break the glass slipper. She's already, you know, Tremaine already figured out it's Cinderella locking her in the tower. And then just tripping the man here, the footman, and just breaking the glass slipper. Like, hey, you know, if my daughters are not going to marry the prince, no one's going to marry the prince.
Yeah, and Cinderella just does that really baller move at the end there. Where it's like, it's okay, I've got the other one. And the look they animated on Lady Tremaine's face was like, what? I love it, but I love how she says, thank you, fairy godmother, when she sees that the glass slipper is still intact earlier in the film.
Yeah, it's like that was the godmother's gift to her was the glass slippers.
Yeah, a memory of the evening she probably thinks at that point, but I think the fairy godmother probably just knew your stepmother is going to ruin this somehow, so I'm going to give you a backup plan.
Yeah.
I also like that, you know, there is the repetition of the fact that this woman is always losing a shoe.
Yeah, and it happens three times in this movie.
Yeah, of course, there's the big one, you know, at the ball when she's running down. But earlier in the movie, she loses one of her sensible little ballet flats, which, by the way, I love. who doesn't love like a nice classic black ballet flat? But she loses that walking up the stairs to deliver the morning tea. She loses it again on the stairs at her wedding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so maybe it's just Cinderella and stairs are not a thing that mixes well.
She needs laces on her shoes.
Yeah, she needs some kind of ties or straps or something, you know.
Yeah.
But I do like the repetition throughout the film.
Yeah.
So cute. Oh, I just love this movie. It's such a feel-good movie.
Yeah. I think that's all we can talk about.
This was nice after the last 2 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's all we could talk about with Cinderella. I don't think we can say any more, but yeah, the question's already been answered. Does this movie have the Disney magic? Absolutely.
Every single second of this film is Disney magic. I don't think we came up with a single thing to ding this film on other than the prince could use a personality.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything else in this film is flawless. All the other characters are well-rounded and suit their purposes well. The plot flows very well. Not a single second that feels like it drags or that it's wasted or that you could cut it.
Yeah.
Amazing songs.
Yeah. Amazing.
Beautiful animation. It just so, oh, I just love it. I love every bit of it. I want to wrap myself inside this movie like a nice blanket fresh out of the dryer.
This was the movie that saved the Disney studio after the war, and with good reason.
Yeah, just so great. I just love this movie so much.
Of the older Disney movies, this probably has the most active characters in the park. Because you have Cinderella. You actually have Tremaine and the sisters, and the fairy godmother.
Yeah. Occasionally you can see the prince, but nobody really cares.
I love the fact that the fairy godmother is such an active character in the parks because it gives older actresses a role to play in the park.
Yeah. Also, as far as, you know, full costume characters, Jacques and Gus Gus show up. Now and then.
Yeah, now and then.
They're not as common as the human characters, but they do show up in a lot of the parades and a lot of the special events. So I don't think there's so much a specific meet and greet for those two, but you can find them now and then at special events, which
Stepsisters are fun to based on every video I've seen of these two. They're just those two, whoever's playing those two characters have the time of their lives because they just get to act rotten and people will love them for it.
Yeah. So great. I know that there are certain types of people that are like, I really want to play, you know, Snow White, or I really want to play, you know, one of the other characters, but there's like, I love the cast members that are like, I want to be, you know, the wicked stepsister. I want to be the kind of off kilter or slightly villainous character, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, of course, we talked about Cinderella's castle at Walt Disney World and the fact that there is an actual suite in that castle that people can stay in.
Yeah.
It's expensive as hell and was originally built for Walt Disney, but unfortunately he passed away before the park could be finished. But yeah, if you have a lot of money, you could probably stay in Cinderella's castle.
If you have a lot of money, you're definitely not listening to our show.
Yeah,
I don't think that's our particular segment. No, I think that it's interesting that Cinderella's castle is not only the basis for the logo.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in two Disney parks. It's in Walt Disney World and Tokyo Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of merchandise recreating the castle, you know, figurines and Christmas ornaments and snow globes, and, you know, it's on t-shirts and stuff. So that castle may be more iconic than the main character herself, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's a great film. It's a great film. If you haven't watched it recently, you need this film in your life right now. It's just, everything about it is wonderful. Go treat yourself.
So let's move on to what we're going to be talking about next week. We are going to go forward in the timeline a bit for Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, and I'm going to say I'm really looking forward to the rewatch of this one, because growing up, this was my favorite classic Disney film. So we'll see if that holds up. I had forgotten how good Cinderella is, so I don't know. Maybe Cinderella has taken the title. We'll have to see.
Yeah, another princess film. Let's see what Disney's third attempt at a princess film, what have they improved on since this one? And we'll be talking about that next week. Go watch Cinderella if you haven't. It still holds up. It's still a great movie.
Yeah.
And tune in next week for Sleeping Beauty, and we will talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye. Don't let the magic stop here.
Join our conversation online on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic.
Twitter at Rewatch the Magic.
And of course, new episodes every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com.
Remember, the magic is for everyone.
It only stops if you let it.